first time out. I shrugged. Mama, this is not the dress.
But you look so...
Mama, I want you to close your eyes. And for just one moment, forget how excited you are about me finally getting married and how excited you are about finally seeing me in an actual wedding dress. Close your eyes and really think about my body type and what looks good on me. Mama complied. Now open your eyes, I said. Her eyelids popped open and she scanned me from head to toe. She blanched and made her, I smell something, face. She shook her head as if that would make the image go away. Oh, honey, no. I nodded, my lips tucked into a humorless grimace. There we go.
That is not the dress.
I shook my head slowly.
I would like this off of me now.
Claire helped me wrestle the skirt back into the dressing room.
Don't feel bad, Miss Jameson. This dress has been here since 1992. It's been forced on countless brides by their mothers. It's still here. That should tell you something.
I thought of all the women who had worn this dress before me and shuddered.
We have it cleaned a few times a year, she assured me.
The rest of the evening was a blur, as my friends and family argued over which silhouette suited me best. Jenny and Mama went to search in the back room, where the owner stored the dresses for brides with problem areas. Iris had begun making notes on which manufacturers she could call for special samples. What's that? I asked, pointing to the light blue-gray dress hanging on a rack near the register. Claire laughed.
Oh, that's a dress for the costume shop down the street. Our seamstresses do repairs and alterations for them all the time. Dee Dee Wilkins Reed dressed up as Elizabeth Bennet for some charity costume thing a few weeks back and split a seam. That just goes to show that dress clothes and a few dozen sausage balls don't mix.
Andrea, Jolene, and I shuddered collectively. I stepped closer to the dress. I lifted the plastic bag protecting the material and smiled. This was the sort of dress an Austen character would wear in a highly sanitized, beautifully lit movie adaptation. And unlike every other dress in this shop, I could actually see myself marrying Gabriel in it. I turned over the tag and saw that the dress was my size. Obviously, the wedding dress gods were smiling on me. Can I try it on? I asked Claire.
I don't see why not. Just avoid any sausage balls.
Not a problem.
It's been dry cleaned, right?
I heard Andrea ask as I went back into the dressing room. I slipped the dress on, and it seemed to caress me like water sliding down my skin. It was light and comfortable. There was a smattering of beadwork along the empire waist, emphasizing the elegant bell of the skirt. The hem was scalloped with lace and beadwork. The sleeves were short and capped, and actually made my arms look long and graceful. I wanted to be married in this dress. That special feeling that all brides talk about, finding the one, this was it. I ripped the curtain back and stepped out. Andrea and Jolene squealed. Confirmed.
Oh my gosh, it's so beautiful,
Andrea gushed as Jenny clapped her hands over her mouth. Jolene's face fell from its usual luminous smile.
But wait, it's a rental gown. People have worn it before you. It's used.
It's vintage, I corrected her.
It's icky, she mewled. I wore vintage at my wedding and you didn't say it was icky,
Andrea said, her brow lifted.
I did, you just didn't hear me,
Jolene retorted, wincing when Andrea punched her arm.
Ow! This is what I get for hanging out with vampires. My aunts tried to warn me.
Your aunts are vicious bitches,
Andrea shot back. Jolene shrugged.
You're not wrong.
Hello? Can we focus on my bridal hotness? I demanded, gesturing to the long, slender lines the dress somehow magicked onto my body.
Jane, I think we need to go with a ball gown and a long-sleeved jacket,
Mama was saying as she emerged from the back room. She stopped in her tracks when she saw me and tilted her head, her expression confused.
Oh, well, that's nice.
Nice? Mama, that's gorgeous, Jenny said, stepping closer so she could examine the beading.
Really, really beautiful, Jane. And so completely you.
It's so nice to hear you say that and know you don't mean it as an insult, I told her. She nodded as she bent to examine the hem.
But it's gray,
Mama said.
And it's not a wedding dress.
But it's an Austin period dress, I objected.
We could definitely build a theme around the dress,
Iris offered.
But it's so plain, Mama whined, and I'm just not getting the bridal feeling from it.
But I am getting a bridal feeling from it.
But why gray? Why not white?
Mama asked. I smirked. Mama, if you really want to have that discussion, I will give you a detailed explanation. For once, I have details to give.
I do not want to hear this,
Andrea said, shaking her head.
I think I do, Jenny said.
When Andrea and Jolene turned toward her surprise, she lifted her hands in a defensive gesture.
I don't think curiosity is out of line.
But, Jane, everyone will think...
No one's going to think anything. It's not like it's possible for me to be pregnant. I'm a vampire. All of the traditional planning rules have been drop-kicked out the window. Besides, wedding dresses weren't traditionally white until Victoria made it popular. It's not an authenticity stamp or anything. So tell me, forgetting that this is supposed to be virginal white, do I look pretty? Mama took my face between her hands.
Absolutely gorgeous.
I made a quick, very persuasive phone call to the owner of the costume shop. I offered her what was easily 3 times the cost of the dress and made sure to give Claire a healthy commission. It wasn't her fault that she sold me something that wasn't part of her stock. Since she wasn't paying for the dress, Mama insisted on having it repaired and thoroughly dry cleaned, and then bought me a pretty pair of gray ballet flats and a little beaded comb for my hair. Since I'd managed to stumble into a theme for the wedding, Iris said I'd actually made her job a little easier. She rattled on about period-appropriate flower choices and food, about little touches we could add to the ceremony to make it more Austenian. Andrea made me promise that we would try to wrestle Dick and Gabriel into cutaway coats and beaver hats. It seemed to help our short time frame that my choices were narrowed. My color schemes were limited to what would go with the pewter gray gown, except for the bridesmaids' gowns. I'd already decided that they were going to be a distinctly non-matchy lemon yellow that Jolene's Aunt Bonnie would have to special order. The kind of yellow one would find on takeout menus or particularly urgent post-it notes. In fact, if the outdoor lighting failed, we could use the color of their dresses to illuminate the ceremony. And yes, I had to use a vendor who hated me because Bonnie held the only pattern left in the continental United States for the Ruffles and Dreams. The very dress I'd had to wear in Jolene's wedding. Revenge would be mine. For a few months, until I revealed the dove gray bridesmaid dresses I actually planned for them to wear. As we were loading our purchases into Big Bertha, Mama pulled me aside and stage whispered,
"What's this I hear about not having Jenny in your wedding party?"
I was caught like a proverbial deer in the headlights. My eyes went wide and my mouth seemed to lock shut. I cleared my throat.
"Oh, well... I know Jenny and I have been getting along better lately, but I'm still not comfortable."
Mama huffed.
"Oh, don't be silly, Jane. How do you think Jenny is going to feel if she's not at least a bridesmaid?"
I thought Jenny would be just fine with it. In fact, when I talked to her about this very subject, her response had been, "I'm fine with that." But, of course, instead of saying that, I said, "I wasn't a bridesmaid in Jenny's wedding."
"Well, Jenny had so many friends, she had a hard time choosing from them. You said you understood."
"Yes, because I didn't want to wear the foofy pink dress she'd picked out. I think I'm doing her a favor in return," I said.
"What will people think if you shut your sister out of your wedding?"
"They're going to think, isn't it nice that Jenny came to the wedding to support Jane instead of going through with that pesky lawsuit?" Mama waved my concerns away with a flick of her wrist.
"That's just silly talk. Jenny, sweetheart, Jane needs to talk to you about finding shoes to match your bridesmaid's dress."
Andrea and Jolene turned to me, twin expressions of confusion and shock on their faces. Having expected some maneuver like this from Mama, I tried to calculate the impact of futilely objecting to the bridesmaid shuffle versus future machinations. I decided to let Mama win this battle, if it meant that she'd stay off my ass in other more important wars. So I bit my lip and said nothing. Jenny scurried around the car, followed by Jolene and Andrea.
"I thought I wasn't going to be in your wedding party," Jenny exclaimed.
"That's what I thought, too, but Mama's insisting."
"Insisting that I wear that hag rag of a dress you picked out?
Gee, thanks, Mama."
"Hag rag?"
Andrea repeated. Jolene sighed.
"I'm sure I had that coming, considering the color of peach I made you wear."
I did my best to look contrite. "I'm sorry."
"No, you're not,"
Jenny muttered. Andrea raised her hand hesitantly.
"Can we go back to hag rag?
Just remember, I will be responsible for planning your bachelorette party," Jenny told me. I snorted. "Anything you do won't be nearly as scary as what Jolene's cousins did." Chapter 11. At some point, your child may challenge you to a fight. Try not to beat the child too badly. Imagine having your mother knock you into unconsciousness. It would be emotionally scarring on several levels. Siring for the Stupid, A Beginner's Guide to Raising Newborn Vampires. I knew that Gabriel was feeling better when he threw Jamie through a wall. Tension in the house had been increasing since I went back to work. I think Grandma Ruthie was making her presence known by moving cell phones and checkbooks and anything else we needed. She would hover over us in our sleep, whispering. She'd pop up behind us in mirrors and corners of rooms. Aunt Jetty was spending most of her time patrolling the grounds with Mr. Wainwright, but every time she sensed Grandma Ruthie materializing, she'd pop into the house. The amount of energy she was expanding left her exhausted. Gabriel and Jamie were increasingly cranky with each other. Gabriel's recovery from the poisoning was slow. We figured out that several small meals of donor blood throughout the night healed him a lot faster than bottled synthetic, but he was still pale and weak. He was able to get out of bed, but he hobbled like a man who was nearing his bicentennial birthday. Feeling weak, dependent, brought out the worst in him. He was still loving and appreciative of me, but everything about Jamie set his fangs on edge. Little disputes over dirty laundry on the floor and sorting the recycling became screaming matches. Gabriel would corner me and complain about my inconsiderate brattling of a child. Jamie would pout in his room until I came to investigate his absence, then make forced confessions of how much easier life would be without Gabriel living with us. Things at the shop weren't much better. Once word got around that I was back to work, every other person who came through the door asked me to turn them. I heard every sob story possible, from terminal illness to needing a few extra decades to pay off student loans. Oddly enough, my vampire clientele increased. It was as if I'd passed some sort of test. I was a real vampire now. The vandalism had dropped off completely with the installation of the security cameras. The only glimpse we'd caught of the perpetrators was a hunting boot as the person stepped just a tiny bit into the frame, saw the camera, and ran away. I lived on edge, fearful of what each evening would bring. I was afraid of walking to the door every night. I was afraid to let Gabriel get too close to the windows. I tried to devote my attention to wedding details, to something hopeful, but with Iris on the case, there wasn't much for me to do. After deciding on the Austin theme, she'd pretty much run the show, sending me daily progress reports and emailing pictures of the invitations, linens, and other items she'd arranged. And then, Jamie got a look at the old-fashioned morning coat Gabriel would be wearing and nearly fell over laughing, which started another argument, which sent me running for work early that night. So, when I came home and heard the commotion from the driveway, I gritted my teeth and stomped up the front porch steps. At this point, I was hoping that the happy archer had broken into our home for a rumble, because I didn't think I could put up with much more stepsire drama. How could Jerry Springer not have featured this on his show yet? I opened the door, to find Gabriel growling as he pinned Jamie to the wall by his throat. Panic rippled up my spine. I knew there had been an edgy tension between the two of them, but I never thought Gabriel would lose control of himself like this. He looked like one of those angry stepdads you saw in domestic violence PSAs. "What is going on here?" I yelled. Gabriel's eyes darted toward me, and Jamie took advantage of this and punched Gabriel in the jaw. He followed through the swing, clipping Gabriel's chin with his elbow. Gabriel's hands closed over Jamie's throat and squeezed. Jamie clawed at his hands, finally breaking the hold by punching him in the chest. Gabriel dropped to the ground, sliding his feet against Jamie's legs, knocking him forward. He hooked his hands under Jamie's arms and tossed him as he rolled on his back. Jamie yelped as he flew through the air and flopped bonelessly against the wall, which buckled under the impact. Jamie's legs flopped through the drywall. From my vantage point, I could see his feet resting in the parlor and his torso stretching into the hall. "Gabriel! Jamie! Stop it! This instant!"
"Hi, Jane,"
Jamie said brightly. Gabriel took advantage of this lapse in attention and socked Jamie in the mouth. Aunt Jetty materialized at my elbow. She looked amused but sheepish.
"We tried to stop them, sweetheart, but it was too entertaining."
Mr. Wainwright appeared next to her and added,
"Did you know that Jamie used to wrestle with his friends in his backyard and upload the footage to YouTube?"
YouTube? I spluttered. "What?"
"Jamie's signature move was getting hit in the back with a folding chair," Jetty said, a gleeful glint in her eyes. "I tried to find one in the garage, but I think your Grandma Ruthie came over last year and borrowed the card table and chairs for her bridge club."
Wait. Gabriel, Jamie, what in the name of SpongeBob are you doing?"
"Gabriel was just showing me some moves,"
Jamie said, elbowing Gabriel in the gut. Gabriel grunted and punched Jamie in the kidney.
"We were watching Underworld, and Gabriel said Celine's movements were preposterous and tactically ill-advised."
The accurate, yet slightly exaggerated, pomposity in Jamie's imitation of Gabriel sent a little shiver down my spine. "Given the latex catsuit she was wearing, I tend to agree," I mused. Jamie grinned at me.
"He tried to show me how one of the fight scenes would look in the real world."
"And that ended in the partial destruction of a house that survived the Civil War. How?" I asked.
"Everything after the first hammerlock gets a little hazy,"
Gabriel confessed, shaking his head as if there were something loose inside. Jamie grinned and helped Gabriel off the floor. Gabriel slapped him on the back and chuckled. They seemed to have bonded over beating each other senseless. I moaned and scrubbed a hand over my face. For the first time, I felt truly outnumbered in my own home. I thought perhaps I was better off when they were pointedly ignoring each other. Still, it seemed like a step in the right direction for Gabriel. He hadn't had this much exercise in weeks. His face was no longer the color of overboiled oatmeal, and he was moving as if he had cartilage in his joints. "Call the contractor to get this fixed. And try to stay away from the load-bearing walls, okay?" Jamie struggled up from the floor and tossed Gabriel into the kitchen by his ears. "On second thought, why don't you take this outside?" I turned toward Aunt Jetty and Mr. Wainwright, who were already phasing through the door to check the woods around the house for intruders.
"I'm going to get a snack. I'll be right out,"
Jamie called, jogging into the kitchen. Gabriel met him at the doorway, elbow-checking him as he walked out, and then turned his attention to me. "You worry me," I told Gabriel as his arms slipped around my waist. "You worry me so much." Gabriel slipped his hands under my shirt, tracing my ribs with his fingertips. "I take it you're feeling better?" I asked him. He gave me a lopsided grin as he brushed kisses along my jaw.
"We can't,"
I whispered as he nipped at my earlobe and did that thing with his tongue that made my eyelids flap like window shades.
"We can't what?"
"We can't." I made a meaningful eye gesture that in feminine circles meant sex, or maybe over there. "Jamie's just down the hall, and he has super hearing."
"He's a big boy, Jane. I'm pretty sure he knows that we have intimate relations."
"Oh, why did you say it like that?" I groaned. "That's what my grandma called it." Gabriel shuddered, dropping his hands away from my breasts and scooting away from me.
Well, bringing up your grandmother effectively prevented all future erections, so thank you.
I'm just uncomfortable with the idea of him being in the house when we're having... Don't say intimate relations. Don't say intimate relations.
Happy naked fun time?
Gabriel suggested.
Exactly.
I nodded.
So, what's your suggestion?
He asked.
Are we going to resort to outdoor sex for the duration of his stay?
Not with Gabriel hating archers waiting outside our door.
Is that supposed to be funny?
He asked.
I thought it was pretty funny,
Jamie yelled from the kitchen.
And yes, I can hear you, every word, and I do not want to be anywhere near happy naked fun time.
Gabriel's jaw went slack with horror, and I burst out laughing.
Sinners,
Jamie yelled. I backed toward the door, giving Gabriel a positively sinful smile. I'd closed my hand around the doorknob just as a knock sounded on the other side. Gabriel was at my side in a flash. He looked through the peephole and pulled the door open. Ophelia was standing on the other side. In place of her usual outfits, she was wearing khaki capri pants and a cute red-checked summer blouse with cap sleeves. Her thick brown hair was smoothed back with a little red headband, for goodness sake. She looked as if she were heading to a church picnic. I wondered who, if anyone, stayed with Georgie while Ophelia was out. She was often running around on council business. Did she pop in a DVD for Georgie and hope for the best? Would a 400-year-old child be offended if you got her a babysitter? Given her reference to plague rats, I would guess yes. But I knew that referring to Ophelia's baby sister in front of Gabriel would not improve my tenuous rapport with my local council representative. So, for the first time, I kept my mouth shut in front of Ophelia.
You seem to be healing quickly enough, Ophelia said,
her tone dry as she eyed Gabriel's arm slung around my shoulders. Gabriel cleared his throat and immediately became prim, proper, public Gabriel, which he always seemed to do when Ophelia was around.
Yes, I am.
You know, it's customary to invite someone in when they're standing on your doorstep, she said, smiling sweetly.
Won't you please come in, Ophelia? I asked, making an exaggerated sweeping gesture with my arm like a game show hostess on crack. Rolling her eyes at me, and looking very much her physical age, she strolled past me. She caught sight of the mangled interior wall and turned.
Remodeling?
Male bonding, I responded, at which Gabriel nudged me in the ribs. Ophelia chuckled.
Yes, that's why I stopped by. I wanted to see how you and your young charge are getting along. I was a little concerned after our conversation. Between your siring duties and your usual personal peccadilloes, I would hate for you to be overwhelmed.
Peccadilloes? I parroted. That's a bit unfair. Troubles? Sure. Drama? Certainly. But peccadilloes makes me sound like something out of a Wilkie Collins novel.
Jane is doing a fine job with Jamie,
Gabriel told her.
Considering.
Considering? I turned toward Gabriel to give him a scathing glare.
It's a figure of speech,
he assured me. An insulting figure, I grumbled.
I'm doing just fine. Our discussion the other day helped put things in perspective for me.
She gave me a small smile, then turned that frank, disconcerting gaze on Gabriel.
I understand that congratulations are in order. I was a little insulted that you didn't tell me earlier. You know that the council tracks all vampire marriages.
Well, we've been a little busy, what with the parenting and the poisoning and all, I said. Ophelia's smile widened.
Yes, I received Dick's test results, which were quite impressive, by the way. The array of toxins used can leave no doubt about what the archer intended. Waco and Peter were somewhat concerned that yours was a test case, a dry run, so to speak, for attempts on other vampires.
So, if nothing else, we can use connections with local businesses to watch for humans buying large quantities of rat poison and aspirin. Forewarned is forearmed and all that. I only ask that you let the council handle any lab testing in the future. We know you're very resourceful when you need to be, but if there was a deeper investigation into the matter, we would want to be able to prove that the samples were not tampered with.
I will definitely take advantage of that in the future,
I don't think I can afford frequent access to Dick's connections.
I know what you mean, she said. Do you have any idea how expensive children's footwear from the 1930s can be, even with the Dick Cheney discount?
I can honestly say no.
Why would you need...
Gabriel began to ask. Never mind, Ophelia and I chorused.
Did you know that Bud McElroy had a brother? Ophelia asked, watching me carefully.
I subtly shifted my gaze toward Gabriel, whose hand closed over my shoulder in a comforting squeeze.
It's all right, Jane.
How does she know about Bud? I asked. It wasn't exactly a secret among our friends, but I thought we'd been able to keep Gabriel's tree-pushing tendencies off the council's radar.
I had to tell her,
Gabriel assured me.
When she was investigating you for murder, she demanded the complete story of your turning. I named Bud as the hunter responsible for your shooting. When he turned up dead, she connected the dots.
And you're not in trouble for it?
He was given a rather large fine, Ophelia conceded. The only thing that saved him from the trial was that Mr. McElroy wouldn't be missed by outspoken family members. And Gabriel had managed his little bit of revenge without stirring up much public interest.
Is that why you asked about Bud's brother?
Did you know him?
His name's Ray McElroy, I said, shrugging. His grandma went to church with my parents, so the only information I have is from prayer concerns about him and his brother. Ophelia's confused expression prompted me to imitate my mother's voice.
Please pray for poor Velma, as she had to sell 10 acres to pay for Bud's fourth stint in rehab. And please pray for Ray as he begins his community service for assaulting a meter reader.
Gabriel shuddered.
We've talked about that voice, Jane.
Ophelia snickered. Rolling my eyes, I added, he was a big-deal football player in his day, took the Howlers closer to state than they'd ever been, before or since. He actually went to college for 2 semesters before he blew out his knee and his scholarship got pulled.
Do you know where he is now?
Yeah, he's in jail, I said, trying to remember the last bit of gossip Mama had shared with me about Ray. He has been since about 2 years before I was turned. You know those big reels of scratch-off lottery tickets they have at the front of convenience stores? Gabriel nodded. Well, Ray kicked in the front of the Quickie Stop and stole one of them.
That's surprisingly clever, Gabriel said.
It would have worked out, too, except that when you claim scratch-off winnings of more than $600, you have to present valid identification. He was smart enough to redeem his winning tickets at different stores around the area, but the lottery board noticed when one man claimed more than $70,000 in scratch-off winnings within a 20-mile radius of where a reel of tickets had been reported stolen. Still, it's far more respectable than Bud's antics, which included peeing in a public fountain during a Memorial Day service. Ophelia's lips twisted into a disdainful moo.
And if I told you that Ray had recently been paroled and hasn't reported to his parole officer in 2 weeks?
So wait, you think the arrow has something to do with Gabriel's pushing the tree on top of Bud McElroy? I turned to Gabriel.
You mean they're really after you, not me?
It's possible, he conceded.
Oh, okay then. Gabriel scowled at me.
And by okay, I'm sure you mean, oh, my love, whatever will I do if you come to harm?
He said dryly.
No, it's just that I'm so used to people coming after me, it's kind of a refreshing change of pace.
Gabriel pinched his nose as if he was trying to ward off a headache.
It's my ability to find the silver lining in any situation that endears me to you, I reminded him.
I turned to Ophelia. I don't suppose you've taken Ray into custody for questioning and this whole thing could be wrapped up tidily in the next few days? Ophelia gave me a patronizing smirk.
Of course not. We haven't been able to track him down either. He has no family in the area, no property. It's like he stepped out of the facility in Eddyville and disappeared. And considering that he's being tracked by creatures with supernatural hunting instincts, that's quite the accomplishment.
It makes sense. Mama said Ray went a little survivalist after the college dropout thing. He lived in these little hunting shanties he'd built out in the woods behind his grandparents' place, till the house was repossessed and he sort of became a permanent camper out at the state park. When he went to jail, his camper was towed to an impound lot, and Bud got his pickup truck.
How could you possibly get that many details from gossip your mother mentioned in passing years ago?
Ophelia asked. Wacko survivalist lotto thieves tend to stand out in my memory. The human grapevine works just like the vampire's gossip circuit, I said. It's just a little more oriented around coffee and cake. She cleared her throat.
Yes, we'll be seeking Ray McElroy for questioning. I think it should go without saying that you should stay on your guard.
And yet you're saying it anyway, Gabriel muttered. I snorted, surprised that Gabriel was actually sassing the one person who seemed to intimidate him. Clearly, I was a bad influence on him. Or maybe Jamie was a bad influence on him. Ophelia pointedly ignored his insolence.
Don't go wandering around your property willy-nilly. Use caution while you're at your shop. We'll continue to have council representatives discreetly drop by there and here. And please, please, do not try to track Mr. McElroy down yourselves. You've proven how well you handle these confrontations on your own. We don't want a repeat of the Missy situation or the Janine debacle.
I handled them fine, I mumbled.
What was that? She asked.
I shook my head, smiling blithely.
You know, I've had vampires doing random checks of the woods surrounding your property off and on for days, and they haven't turned up so much as a suspicious scent. Frankly, they're getting a little bored. You're not very interesting to watch, you know. They'd heard all these wonderfully scandalous stories about you, and you're hardly living up to the hype.
I suppose I have you to thank for telling those scandalous stories, I muttered. Ophelia had the good grace to cover her snicker with a cough.
Have you given any more thought to who might have shot at you? She asked.
I snorted. No, it's not like I've devoted every waking thought to it since the night it happened. I mean, what's a debilitating poisoning between friends? Gabriel opened his mouth, but my wayward child chose this moment to jog back from the kitchen, his torn T-shirt slung over his shoulder.
You ready to be beaten on some more, old man?
He asked. Jamie's skin still held the faintest flush of his pre-death tan, and the muscles he'd gained from years of baseball rippled as he moved. He shot Gabriel one of his million-watt grins, the white of his teeth somehow making the green of his eyes stand out even further. He noticed the sweet-looking teenager standing to my left and ratcheted up the power of his smile. For her part, Ophelia was staring openly at my child, barely restraining the drool that threatened to drip down her chin. My motherly instincts found this to be somewhat offensive, considering that I was standing 3 feet away, but I bit my tongue and stored it away for future blackmail material.
Does he always walk around without his shirt like that?
She asked, the last syllable cracking slightly. Behind her, Gabriel choked on a chortle. No, I said pointedly. Jamie knows better. In fact, after introducing himself politely, he will be going right upstairs and changing into something that covers his manscaping.
I'm Jamie,
he said, reaching out to shake Ophelia's hand.
Nice to meet you. And I don't manscape, but Gabriel does.
Gabriel punched Jamie's shoulder, and Jamie smacked him back. He gave Ophelia a good-natured wink, and I cringed a little. Jamie had no idea how ancient Ophelia was or her position of authority. In Jamie's mind, Ophelia was 15, 2 years younger than he was, and not quite a dating candidate. He was giving her the polite sort of charm he'd probably bestow on a friend's cute younger sister. Friendly, but nothing too promising. Ophelia seemed to be caught in some sort of force field. She couldn't move. She couldn't speak. She couldn't look away from Jamie's goofy, sunny face. I cleared my throat. Jamie? Shirt? Jamie chuckled.
Right. Sorry.
He took the stairs two at a time, with Ophelia's eyes glued to his back. I waved my hand in front of her face, and she seemed to shake out of her stupor. Her eyes focused on my smirking face, and she fell right back into business mode.
We'll take care of this, Jane, she said, leveling me with those ancient eyes. This is what we do, protecting the safety and interests of our vampire constituents. You were wise to bring this to our attention.
Now, continue that line of rational thinking and let us handle it. It will save me so much paperwork.
I sighed. I promise.
You promise what? She asked. I need specifics.
I promise not to put myself in a situation I have to be rescued from, I grumbled as Jamie trotted back down the stairs wearing a wife beater that showed off his arms. It was the dude equivalent of a low-cut halter top and booty shorts. My child was a hussy.
Good girl, she said, patting my head. Gabriel, it was lovely as always. Jane, stay out of trouble. Jamie, it was a pleasure.
She smiled demurely at him and gave a little wave as she sauntered out of the foyer.
She seems cool,
Jamie said, peering out the front window to watch Ophelia climb into her car.
How old is she?
I found my right pointer finger raised and hovering 2 inches in front of Jamie's nose. Jamie, no.
What?
Jamie demanded.
She seems like a nice girl. You said that if I date, it has to be another vampire.
Not that vampire, I insisted. And she's not a nice girl. Nice girls don't threaten innocent librarians with dismemberment on a regular basis. Jamie's face was puzzled, but he was still eyeing the door as if he was considering chasing Ophelia down the driveway and asking for her cell phone number. Honestly, where was his loyalty? Clearly, constantly belittling and threatening one's sire was nothing compared with the overwhelming influence of male hormones. She's 400 years old, I blurted out. Jamie did a bit of a double take.
Really?
Yes. That doesn't make her a cougar. That makes her a saber-toothed tiger. Jamie grinned.
That's kind of hot.
You're going to ask her out just to spite me, aren't you?
Maybe.
Why couldn't you have been a girl? I groaned. Chapter 12. There will be nights, just before dawn, when you will wonder, what has happened to my life? What happened to staying out all night and drinking the blood of the innocent? The answer is simple. You became a sire. Siring for the Stupid, a beginner's guide to raising newborn vampires. Of course, I immediately started looking into Ray McElroy's whereabouts. I didn't plan to confront him. I just wanted to find him so I could point the council in the right direction. I meant no offense to the council and its resources, but I had a lot more faith in my own research skills. Do not mess with a librarian with a history of cyber-stalking her vampire sire and various step-grandparents. Unfortunately, those skills got me jack squat. The house where Bud and Ray grew up had burned to the ground right after I left for college. None of the neighbors remembered anything about the family after their Grandma Velma died. The Half Moon Hollow Library hired a new youth librarian who realized that the library's passwords to state databases hadn't changed since I was fired. So, that cut off my access to birth and death records. I had to use Google like everybody else. It was demoralizing. As I was entering my credit card information into peoplefinder.com, I welcomed the distraction of Zeb and Jolene dragging the twins through my front door. Well, technically, Jolene had a baby under each arm. Zeb was loaded down with the ridiculous amount of paraphernalia required to sustain 2 babies. Jolene huffed a breath out as she dropped the combined weight of 3 people on my couch.
My cousin down at the DMV says Ray hasn't come in to renew his driver's license, which did expire while he was in prison. Also, you owe him a ham, the expensive kind, from Italy.
I took Janelyn from her and nuzzled her head of strawberry blonde hair. I feel like I should be doing my own meat-based negotiations. Parma ham isn't cheap.
Well, to be fair, he is risking his job to help you track the guy who could be trying to kill your fiancé,
Zeb pointed out as I jiggled Janelyn on my knee. Oh, fine. Put it in perspective, why don't you? I sighed.
What about tax records, voter registration, magazine subscriptions? Jolene asked.
He can't pay taxes on wages he doesn't earn. I don't think he's legally allowed to vote, and I don't think I want to know what kind of magazines he likes, I answered.
I think you're going about this the wrong way, Zeb said. You're looking in all the right places, all the places the council's going to check anyway. You need to get down and dirty. You need to check all the places the council won't think of. You know things about people who live here, the weird, hollow underbelly that some ancient pencil pusher wouldn't even consider a possibility. You need to embrace the dick factor.
Jolene opened her mouth to comment. I raised my hand and put a finger to her lips.
So what does that mean? I asked. Bars? Bingo halls? Parking lots of shady roller rinks?
Well, I haven't heard a bad idea yet, Zeb said. But I think you need to think outside the coffin, so to speak. Where is he getting his money? Where would he spend his time? He just got out of prison. What's his favorite food? The first place he'd head for a pig out?
I don't know. It's not like I can find enough information on him to create a dossier. I have secondhand gossip from my mama.
Do you think she knows anything else?
Jolene asked.
Maybe you should call her?
I'm doing pretty well keeping Mama off my back with all the wedding stuff, thanks to Iris's brilliant maneuverings. I don't think I should tempt fate.
Hi, sweetie.
I turned to find that my mother was bustling through my front door, carrying an enormous 3-ring binder covered in pink chantilly lace.
What have you done?
I hissed at Jolene.
Maybe $1 million should drop out of the sky,
Jolene said, peering at the front door.
Oh, sure. For that, your evil powers don't work,
Zeb muttered. Mama kissed my cheek and set her binder on the coffee table with a thud. Gabriel and Jamie had emerged from the kitchen to say hello to Zeb and Jolene, but seeing my mother, they simultaneously turned on their heels and used their vampire speed to disappear. I definitely liked it better when they weren't getting along.
Mama, what are you doing here? With binders?
I waited for her to look down into her binder and said, I thought Iris had all this stuff at her house to protect it, keep it in one place.
Oh, I found her address and stopped by earlier to pick up some information I needed.
Iris had an unlisted number, lived in the middle of nowhere, and regularly took 4 different routes home to keep her clients from finding her house. Clearly, I had underestimated Mama's resourcefulness. Again. Maybe I should have asked Mama to find Ray McElroy. She'd have him hogtied in the back of her car in time to go home and watch Law and Order. You didn't break into her house, did you? Mama ignored the question, instead wedging herself between Jolene and me on the couch and plopping a sheaf of magazine pages onto my coffee table.
Sweetie, I have a very important question for you, she said, her tone solemn.
For a brief, horrifying moment, I thought for sure she had figured out the whole Grandma Ruthie haunting problem and was going to ask me just to play nice with Ruthie for eternity for the sake of family harmony. Mama took a deep breath.
What are you thinking as far as wedding favors?
I have to say I haven't been thinking of them at all, really.
Well, I think those little packs of Jordan almonds are becoming sort of passé, and no one does the tiny bottle of bubbles anymore. I was thinking little white plastic caskets filled with candy.
No, I said, shaking my head very slowly. Not a chance. Jolene added,
one of our fancier cousins was really into frisbee golf, so he and his wife had nice monogram frisbees made up and gave them as favors.
You want to put Dick next to an open bar and then hand him something he can throw at us? I asked.
Well, we can table this discussion until we get some better ideas,
Mama said.
Oh, I wanted to go over the menu for the reception with you. I know you don't eat, but you know how your Uncle Dave can be if his blood sugar gets low. So I think we need to double the variety of appetizers distributed during the photos.
I sighed, reminding myself that photos were the only traditional wedding folderol that Mama was absolutely insistent on. She figured that this was the only wedding she was getting out of me, so she wanted it to be well documented. And serving appetizers while people waited around for us was just the polite thing to do. By his blood sugar getting low, do you mean he has too many beers and starts griping about Aunt Vi's addiction to QVC? I asked.
Exactly,
she said, pulling a page ripped from a bridal magazine out of her binder and handing it to me.
What do you think of these?
Mini cheeseburgers?
I asked, passing the burger pictorial to Jolene. Are we going to let White Castle do the catering? That's an idea I can actually support. Don't be silly, she chuckled, pulling out another spread on the virtues of mini quiches. But your daddy would be thrilled. He just wants to make sure we have Swedish meatballs.
Why is all the food miniature?
Jolene whispered, clearly horrified. Werewolf metabolism ran ridiculously high to help fuel their change. They had to scarf down calories all day just to sleep all night, like a little hibernation. Thanksgiving in a werewolf clan was like a full-on farm livestock massacre. And major celebrations like weddings were the sort of horrifying tale that barnyard animals might whisper to their children to keep them in line. Zeb muttered,
There's going to be a full dinner afterward. Calm down.
Look, I don't think you need to worry about all this, I said. Pick whatever is going to make you and Daddy happy. Jolene cleared her throat, so I added, And Jolene.
But honey, you know what a nightmare it can be to make your aunts happy meal-wise. Aunt Lila's on Atkins again. Aunt Gladys refuses to eat anything but tuna from the can.
I really don't see anybody from the family coming to the wedding, Mama. I haven't spent any time with them since I came out. I don't think they're going to be comfortable around me.
Oh, Jane, now you're really being silly, she said. You spent Christmas with the family this year.
I spent Christmas with you and Daddy this year, after the other relatives left for dinner at Aunt Tootsie's.
Well, that's because you couldn't join us for lunch, she sniffed. Now, let's be serious, Jane, about these mini quiches.
Rather than face a cheese versus spinach debate, I blurted out, Hey, Mama, do you remember Ray McElroy? Mama made a clucking noise in her throat and claimed Joe from Jolene. She sighed and nuzzled the head of the closest thing she'd ever get to a grandbaby.
Poor Velma. Never could get those grandsons of hers straightened out. It just broke her heart, right up until the end. I'm just glad she passed before that no-account Bud had his hunting accident.
Jolene raised her eyebrows at me, questioning. I gave an imperceptible shake of the head, and she pressed her lips shut.
And then Ray being sent to prison over something as silly as lotto tickets. I say, if you're going to go to jail for thieving, be a man about it and rob a bank. Go big or go home.
Sometimes your mom is freaking brilliant, Zeb marveled.
Mama preened.
Thank you, Zeb.
But no one's heard from him since he got out of prison? I asked.
Not really. I mean, I know he went by Margie Nash's florist shop to make sure the flowers on Bud and Velma's graves are changed every 2 months. Margie mentioned it at the quilt shop the other night. She said he seemed really torn up over Bud dying while he was in prison.
I don't suppose he left a billing address, I asked. Mama shook her head, a perplexed expression creasing her brow.
You know, it's funny. Margie said he refused to give her one.
Credit card information?
Jane, what on earth is going on with you? Why are you asking all of these questions about someone you barely know? Oh, my lord, is this another one of those vampire things? When did Ray get turned?
No, Mama, Ray's not a vampire. Did Margie say she saw him during the day? I asked. When she nodded, I said, Okay, so he's still alive. I just need to talk to him, and I'm having a hard time tracking him down, that's all.
Talk to him about what?
Mama demanded.
Shit.
I was drawing a total blank. Why had my verbal incontinence chosen this moment to abandon me?
She owes him money,
Jolene piped up. I shot her an incredulous look. Jolene, proud of her quick thinking, added,
Well, actually, she owed Bud money. He did some yard work for her right before he died, and she was never able to pay him. She's felt guilty about it, and she wants to pay Ray instead.
Okay. I had to admit that was pretty impressive. Zeb beamed at her.
You gave Bud McElroy work, Jane?
Mama asked, her head tilted at me with this strange, unfamiliar expression on her face. Pride.
That was very sweet of you. I hope he didn't take advantage.
Oh, no, Zeb said, grinning. Bud's work really blew Jane away.
I glared at him and mouthed, Too far. So, if you see him, Mama, could you call me? I asked. Right away? And don't approach him or anything. I'd like to talk to Ray about it myself, with him being so torn up about his brother and all.
Sure, baby,
she said, smoothing my hair back from my shoulder and patting my head fondly.
Oh, I almost forgot. I need to see your dress.
Mama bustled out of the living room, leaving me to chase her up the stairs to the master bedroom. I abused my vampire speed to get around her and clean up any incriminating items that might have been lying around our room.
I just want to match the ribbons to the gray of your dress, honey. I think you'd call it colonial pewter, but Iris thinks it's more of a silver streak.
What the hell are you talking about? Mama held up a color wheel from the ribbon manufacturer, and I groaned. You have to be stopped.
Just get the dress out of the closet, smartass.
Mama, I gasped, downright proud that she'd called me a mildly foul name. I pulled the garment bag out of the closet. I knew that something was off the moment I pulled it free. The bag's weight was distributed in a weird bottom-heavy fashion, and the zipper was undone. I was paranoid about Gabriel sneaking a peek at the dress. There was no way I would leave it open like that. That's weird, I muttered, carefully taking the hanger out of the bag. Mama gasped. I was holding what looked like a burial shroud. The bodice of my dress was just a central location for the fluttering wisps of gray silk, the scraps left of the sleeves and skirt. It hadn't been cut. It had been torn, viciously, over and over, until all that remained were shreds. On the closet floor, amid the pile of gray scraps, I saw a pair of long silver sewing scissors. They'd belonged to one of my great aunts, who'd been a quilting enthusiast. I'd hidden them from Grandma Ruthie when I was 10, after she'd made me one too many sailor dresses. I'd spirited them away to the attic and stuck them behind a loose panel in the wall. Clearly, Grandma Ruthie had found them. Just behind my right ear, I heard it. Cold, hissing laughter. My grandma's laughter. Disembodied laughter was probably all she was capable of, considering the effort she put into tailoring my dress. My head swam as the slips of silky material fluttered through my fingers. My dress was destroyed. The only thing I'd actually liked about this whole wedding thing, beyond spending eternity with the man I love and all that hoo-ha, was the dress. And now it could have been used as a costume of a particularly slutty zombie.
Jane?
Mama said apprehensively. I heard her step out into the hallway and call for Gabriel. That is it! I screamed. Gabriel never told me exactly what I yelled after this, because it was sort of a high-pitched audio blur that made Fitz come running into the room. But in Jamie's estimation, from two floors away, it was something along the lines of, "Damn it, that is the absolute limit. It is not enough that I have a teenager running around my house drinking all my blood and reminding me how old I am. I have a crazy person trying to turn my fiancé into a pincushion. I've got to pick out food I can't eat to feed people I don't like and pretend that I'm some sort of sacrificial virgin just so I can sleep with someone who's already living with me. And now I'm not even going to be well-dressed while I do it because some crazy-ass spirit decided to play Edward Scissorhands with the only bridal dress in the state of Kentucky that doesn't make me look like a desperate hooker." My legs went to jelly, slipping out from under me as I collapsed onto the floor. I heard Mama calling my name, her voice muffled as if my head were underwater. Gabriel walked into the room, and some strange instinct had me wanting to hide the dress, since it would be bad luck for him to see it. And then the fact that I was trying to shove ribbons of unrecognizable fabric behind my back made me giggle, and then I was all out laughing hysterically as my vision blurred and my eyes rolled up. I didn't know that vampires could black out, but there I was, lying on the floor in my parlor with Andrea and Jolene standing over me, tutting sympathetically. Andrea helped me sit up while Jolene handed me a warm cup of O-negative. Aunt Jetty and Mr. Wainwright were standing in the corner, Jetty wringing her hands and wiping at her cheeks while Mr. Wainwright stewed. I blinked hazily as my eyes adjusted to the lights, and I saw the pile of rags that used to be my wedding dress. And I started to cry, like a big, old, hysterical bridezilla. Mama dabbed at the streaks of blood on my cheeks with a tissue.
I haven't really cared about any of this wedding stuff. That dress was the one silly wedding thing I was really excited about. Why'd she have to take that away? What the hell did I ever do to her?
What is she talking about? Mama asked. Is she hallucinating? I don't think she hit her head when she passed out.
Where's Gabriel? I asked, sniffing.
Pacing outside the door, Mama said. I called Andrea, and we convinced Gabriel that this was more of a lady issue. I didn't think you'd want him to see you like this.
Also, Jamie heard you screaming and ran for the root cellar. What were you saying, anyway? You were talking so fast I couldn't understand you.
Huh. My mother had actually done what was best for me, based on what I needed. I think that's one of the seven signs of oncoming Armageddon. But instead of being a jerk about it, I said,
Thanks, Mama.
Jane, I'm so sorry, Jetty cried while Mr. Wainwright patted her shoulder. She's gotten so good at hiding from us, operating under the radar. I had no idea what she was up to. If I'd had any idea...
I can't believe she did it, Andrea said. Imagine the energy it took to shred your dress like that.
Jolene growled.
This is it. We're taking this dead bitch down. I don't care who she is, Jane. You don't go messing with a girl's wedding dress.
What are you two talking about? Mama asked. Why are you calling Jamie a dead bitch? I know he can be disagreeable sometimes, but all teenagers are.
What does Jamie have to do with this? Andrea asked.
Well, he ran for the cellar, so I assumed that he destroyed Jane's wedding dress in some sort of adolescent snit.
Jane did it to one of Jenny's pep squad uniforms when they were in high school.
It was her away uniform, and she tore down my wall-sized collage of Keanu Reeves pictures. She had it coming.
Agreed, Andrea said. But if Jamie didn't do it, who did?
Mama asked.
You said she. What did you mean?
I tried to picture telling Mama that her own mother was A, hanging around the earthly plane, and B, spending that time threatening / annoying the bejesus out of me. I didn't see that going over well. So, of course, I was preparing a completely plausible story about further retaliation from the Chamber of Commerce when Jolene said,
She means the ghost of...
The ghost of River Oaks, I exclaimed, shaking my head at Jolene.
Honey, that's silly. The house isn't haunted. River Oaks has been in our family for generations, and we've never heard anything about a ghost, much less a ghost that goes around cutting up dresses. Besides, there's no such thing as ghosts.
Mom, your daughter's a vampire, and you can't believe there's such a thing as ghosts? She frowned.
Good point. Okay, if it's a ghost, who is it?
Jolene, ever freaking helpful, said,
Oh, it's a poltergeist,
I ground out, glaring at her. A poltergeist with absolutely no backstory or personality whatsoever. It was most likely attracted by the chaos of Jamie's adolescent energy. We only call it a her because it does such petty, teenage, dirty, vicious, bitchy, hateful... Andrea cleared her throat.
Okay, Jane, we get it.
Yes, and I'm going to get something, too. An exorcist. Do you hear me, old woman? I don't care who else you take to the next plane with you. You're out.
Well, I didn't understand any of that, Mama said. And right now, I think we need to focus on your dress. Is there any part of it that can be salvaged?
I held the two largest scraps. As a formal blindfold, maybe.
Save that for the honeymoon,
Andrea snickered. Really? You've got jokes? I muttered.
We'll just call the costume shop and see if they have anything like it, Mama said. And if they don't, we might have to go back to the bridal shop.
I groaned.
I'm sorry, Jane, honey.
No, you're not, I shot back. She nodded.
You're right.
I barked out a soggy laugh and swiped at my cheeks. Well, at least you're honest. Mama hitched her purse over her shoulder.
I'm going to call Iris, honey. Don't you worry about a thing. Mama's going to take care of everything.
With that, she kissed me on the forehead and walked into the hallway.
She called over her shoulder.
And you might let Gabriel know you're okay, because he's out here pacing a hole in the carpet.
Gabriel came rushing into the room and threw his arms around me.
I've never heard you make a sound like that before. It was terrifying. Please, don't do it again. All screaming in this room should be of the pleasant variety.
Ew,
Andrea muttered.
We are exercising Grandma Ruthie,
I growled.
Tonight. She's gone too far this time.
Call me names? Fine. Move stuff around? Okay. But this is where I draw the line. Do you hear me, Ruthie? I heard an indignant hiss behind me, but Ruthie wasn't able to do much more than move a few strands of my hair. She was exhausted by her efforts. Now was the best time to strike.
I just happened to have pulled your exercising Grandma Ruthie file while you were, indisposed,
he said, handing me the stack of papers I'd collected on exorcism rites.
You circled the ritual you thought would work best. I sent Dick out to collect a virgin goat.
You are so the guy for me. I sighed and stood on my tiptoes to kiss him thoroughly. Aunt Jetty?
Yes, honey. I'm standing right behind you, she said gently.
I turned around to find her and Mr. Wainwright eyeing me as if I were one of those performing bears that turned on their owners. I need you and Mr. Wainwright to get as far away from here as possible. I don't really know what I'm doing, and I don't want to accidentally send you into the white light.
If we go, we go,
Jetty said.
I don't want you to keep her hanging around the house because you're afraid of hurting me.
What's existence without the risk of the unknown?
Mr. Wainwright said, stroking his cool, misty hand along my cheek.
We're not leaving you until the time is right.
Jetty's cold arms embraced me, sending shivers down my spine.
We'll come back tomorrow night, unless, of course, you jettison us into the great beyond.
That's very helpful. Thanks, I said. As the pair of them faded away, I turned to my favorite werewolf. Jolene, honey, I love you, but you and Zab need to take the kids and go home. I don't want some sort of creepy, accidental possession thing to happen to the twins. Jolene opened her mouth to protest, but quickly shut it.
You're right. I know you're right, and I hate it. I'll find some other way to help. Be careful.
Zeb and Jolene gathered up their brood and headed out. Dick arrived with the goat. I didn't ask questions about where he got it or why he chose to load it into the back seat of Andrea's car rather than his El Camino. While Jamie and Gabriel helped him wrestle it off the half-devoured back seat, Andrea asked,
Are you sure you're not rushing into this?
I shook my head. No.
Do you have any clue what you're doing?
No.
Are you sure this is going to work?